tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hey, KBOO listeners. Join us at the station on February 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. for our Stupid KBOOPID First Friday Art Walk. Enjoy art, listen to music, savor drinks, get your face painted, and pick up a Valentine's gift from one of our amazing vendors. There's something for everyone.
Yes presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll begin with a look at how lawyers are legally challenging the Trump administration's attacks on immigrants, both documented and undocumented. My guest is Miriam Albert of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Then Dr. Brittany Friedman joins me to discuss a new history she's just written, Carceral Apartheid, How Lies and White Supremacists Run Our Prisons. And finally, I'll play a conversation I had last year with Dr. Gina Dent, abolitionist feminist at UC Santa Cruz, but which has never before aired. It's one of 12 interviews with abolitionists that I've done that's included in my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, just published by Seven Stories Press. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Federal immigration enforcement agents have gone on an arresting spree aimed at immigrants across the United States on orders from Donald Trump, who ran for president on an anti-immigrant platform. So far, agents have struck fear into communities, arresting hundreds of people in cities including New York, Phoenix, and even fire-stricken Los Angeles. In an indication that such actions are for political value, agents report being told that they must be, quote, camera ready when making arrests. Leaders of Navajo nations in Arizona and New Mexico are also reporting indigenous Americans being detained and questioned as well. Among the fire hose of executive orders that Trump signed when he took office is an order to end birthright citizenship, the guarantee that being born in the U.S. makes one a U.S. citizen. Amid a slew of lawsuits against that order, a federal judge has temporarily halted its implementation. My guest is Miriam Albert, senior attorney with Lawyers for Civil Rights, representing clients across a wide range of civil rights cases, including employment, educational, and police misconduct matters. Welcome to the program, Miriam.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, the executive order around birthright citizenship was one of the many that was signed on Trump's first day in office. The arrests and raids have come in the days since, and there's so much happening. You know, many are pointing out that the sheer overwhelm is the point. People are very overwhelmed by Trump's aggressive attacks, but the anti-immigrant part of it, none of that should come as a surprise, right? He ran on an explicitly anti-immigrant platform. So I imagine that organizations like yours were expecting basically what has unfurled.
Yes, exactly. Lawyers for Civil Rights and other organizations with similar missions have been, you know, knowing that this might have happened before November, before the election, right? And so we specifically at Lawyers for Civil Rights had planned on preparing things such as Know Your Rights presentations that we knew that our community partners were going to need immediately if Trump were to be elected. And that is exactly what happened. Since Trump was elected, we have continued to hear from both community members all across the greater Boston area, and also from our community partners who are obviously filled with so many calls from people who are undocumented or who may have some temporary status such as TPS or a parole program, all of them freaking out that, you know, they might be the next group targeted. And so one response that our office has done is to create a hotline so that all of our community partners can call us and we can troubleshoot and strategize as to how to deal with issues that are coming through their doors.
Right. And your organization is based in Boston, but you're allied with numerous organizations around the country as well. Let's talk specifically about the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order. It's this idea that no matter who your parents are, if you're born in the United States, by definition, you're a U.S. citizen. This is a widely accepted thing in many countries around the world. That is the case. There are some countries where it isn't the case, but not very many. And for the most part, even in the United States, say there are people who have a resident alien status, such as a green card or any other kind of legal status, even if they're not citizens, their children, if they are born here, are citizens. Why did Trump go against birthright citizenship, and how easy is it for him to attack this? Many are arguing it's wholly unconstitutional.
Thank you, Sonali. Well, why he did it, I mean, I think that I can't really respond to that specific question, but I think we have an idea as to why he may have done it. As you mentioned, a lot of his initial executive actions have been to target immigrant populations and to create chaos and havoc in those communities. And so this is just another one of those actions that he's taken to target immigrants. And this is just something that we feel very strongly about is unconstitutional. Like you said, there's so many legal experts who also feel the same way. And that is because the right to citizenship based on birthplace in the United States is enshrined in the 14th Amendment. That is something that the president cannot change simply, you know, at the whisk of his pen. He can't do that through an executive order. This is something that the Supreme Court has supported and reinforced the idea that citizenship is determined by birthplace, not by the status, immigration status of the child's parents. And so it doesn't matter if a child born here in the U.S. their parents are undocumented. It should not matter. Under the Constitution and years of Supreme Court precedent, that child is entitled to have U.S. citizenship and all of the entitlement and advantages and benefits that come with that. And so this is not something that we think will be able to implement quickly or at all, because one, we've already have several lawsuits in the books trying to target this executive order. And again, we all feel very confident that the law is on our side.
So currently there is an order that's halting its implementation. Does that mean that we expect it to go to the Supreme Court, which, you know, as we know, is stacked with conservatives?
So difficult to predict that, but the temporary restraining order that you're talking about is from the case filed in Washington State. That judge who is on that case implemented a temporary restraining order so that the executive order would not be able to be implemented for at least 14 days. After that, you know, there can be other forms of relief that are sought in each of these cases. For example, our case here in Boston in the District of Massachusetts, after filing the complaint, we also filed a motion for a preliminary injunction to make sure that we're able to stop, press pause on any movement or action to try to implement the executive order. And then from there, you know, it may take some time. There might be some appeals, but our goal is to make sure that it's stopped and never implemented.
If it were to go through, I mean, what does that mean for people who, you know, and I understand that it's meant to take effect starting in January. So anybody who's born to immigrant parents in the United States this month and forward, depending upon how a judge or how the legal proceedings go, that baby, that child, that infant may or may not be a citizen in the future. Are our government agencies not issuing birth certificates and passports at this stage?
So that's another huge question, right? So the executive order says that it wouldn't be implemented until 30 days after the date of the executive order, which would be that it would go into effect February 19 of this year, right? And so every child born after that would be affected. So right now, they're technically, right, no child being stripped of their citizenship, but the executive order also instructs federal agencies such as the Department of State that issues passports and the Social Security Administration to create rules and regulations, guidance as to how this executive order is supposed to be implemented. And there is no other guidance than that, right? So we don't know how this would be, what this would look like on the ground once, if it were to be implemented. And that's another thing that I think most people overlook, that this isn't something that's only going to affect children of immigrants. This is something that is going to have an impact on the lives of every individual in the United States. If citizenship is not determined by birthplace, that means that there would have to be a whole complete change as to how our infrastructure works in this country. And every other person will also have to prove their citizenship, right? Because that, how would they recognize that? You know, what is the Department of State or Social Security Administration? How are they gonna implement this? How are they gonna know if someone is technically a citizen or not, if there are these changes that are going to happen? And that's, again, something that's not just gonna affect the children of immigrants, but everyone moving forward.
So we have a situation where Trump is attacking the ability of people to be able to have citizenship for their children. And then on the other hand, going after immigrants who are living here. And of course, it's being all cast as him going after criminals. There are people who are here with temporary protected status who themselves may be feeling the fear around suddenly being declared quote-unquote illegal and being deported. And then if they have a child here who was born here, everything is up in the air, right? Because most immigrants are parts of mixed status families. So the attacks are coming from different angles, impacting people in different ways. And they're trying to probably, I imagine, figure out you know, what's what, and it just, I cannot imagine how overwhelming and traumatic this is for immigrant communities. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. I can talk a little bit about the community partners that we're representing in this case. In this case, we are representing a community organization called the Brazilian Worker Center and La Colaborativa.
And by this case, you mean this is Lawyers for Civil Rights' lawsuit against the Trump administration?
Correct, in regards to birthright citizenship. And so La Colaborativa and the Brazilian Worker Center work with immigrant communities. They work with pregnant women, right? Pregnant mother or mothers who are gonna have a baby, it may be in the future, who plan to grow their family and who are concerned about this executive order. And one of the concerns that they are hearing and that we've heard as we were working on this case is that parents, immigrant parents, are afraid that their child is going to be stateless, right? there are people who come here and are seeking refuge because there might be political or social unrest in their country of origin. We have community members who are from, for example, Venezuela, where if the child that they have here in the United States does not have U.S. citizenship, it may be very difficult to have their country of origin recognize this child also as a citizen of that country based on the parents' birth in that country. And that's because there is no Venezuela consulate here in the U.S. And so that child would then be stateless. And we know that that's going to impact every aspect of that child's life. If they're stateless, if they have no citizenship, they won't have access to health care. They won't have access to so many necessary resources and things that are just a part of everyday life.
We are being told, and Trump is telling his base, that the whole point of going after immigrants and rounding them up and deporting them, this is separate from the birthright citizenship issue, but the whole point is to root out criminals. And this idea around attacking birthright citizenship is also based on the very racist, quote-unquote, anchor babies idea that people are coming to this country without documents for the sole purpose of being able to have a child on U.S. soil, and therefore then have one member of their family be a U.S. citizen and have that be an anchor to bring them into status. But this idea of going after criminals is so interesting because the people who are being rounded up en masse, if they were supposedly criminals all along, why were they walking around free? How are they arresting people who they, how are ICE officials arresting people who they claim are criminals? Because those people, presumably, if it's known where they are, would have been under criminal proceedings. Or are they simply arresting people who have so-called criminal histories, meaning at one point they had some kind of a charge and may have already served their time? And if so, those two are very different things, right?
Correct, yes. So at Lawyers for Civil Rights, we've been hearing that, you know, it doesn't matter what criminal, if someone has had a criminal charges or history or anything before, there's definitely been ICE raids in different communities, just no matter whether those people have criminal histories or not. We, for example, earlier this month, we had an ICE raid at a huge supermarket in a very predominantly immigrant community here in the greater Boston area. And again, that had nothing to do with whether the workers there or people who were, you know, buying groceries had any criminal history or not. It was just one person that they were targeting who may have had a deportation order or something similar. And then ICE goes into the supermarket and causes a lot of distress and a lot of chaos, right? Because now community members and the rest of the community there was not able to enter that supermarket. There was a lot of panic after that. We've had fears of also hearing from community members that schools are afraid that ICE will come to them. And so attendance has started to decrease and plummeted shortly after this raid that happened at the supermarket. All of these things are, I think, part of the Trump administration's plan, right? Which is something that we mentioned earlier about how it's really just about causing chaos and causing fear within the immigrant community.
Right, overwhelming people with attacks coming so thick and fast that we don't have time to respond, or we get so overwhelmed that we check out. And anybody we seem to also have so much political amnesia, right, Miriam, because the first Trump administration was marked by immigrant family separation, literally taking children away from parents in a way that invoked widespread public outrage. And now everyone's normalizing an administration that was responsible for tearing families apart. And it's just the beginning. This is just the beginning of the second term. Any words of wisdom on how people keep their focus, especially when it comes to an issue of of humanity. Immigrants are part of our economy. They are everywhere, and they frankly make the country run, right?
Right, yeah. Immigrants are definitely a part of the fabric of the United States. And so they are an integral part of our communities. They are part of every aspect of our lives. And organizations like ours, Lawyers for Civil Rights, are obviously here to protect their rights and make sure that any other further action from the Trump administration, we are able to take on and fight on. But I also think that community is super important. And that's something that I've seen here in Boston, is a lot of our community partners are strategizing together, right? Even though we've been under a Trump administration before, this is a time that they've had time to plan, they've had time to prepare. And so things might be a little bit different this time around. And so the only way to be able to confront that is to come all together and to strategize and be able to respond as things come along.
Give out a website for Lawyers for Civil Rights?
Yes, you can go to www.lawyersforcivilrights.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Marianne Albert, senior attorney with Lawyers for Civil Rights, representing clients across a wide range of civil rights cases, including employment, education, and police misconduct matters. Lawyers for Civil Rights is engaged in a lawsuit against the Trump administration over its attack on birthright citizenship. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Donald Trump pardoned nearly 1,600 people involved in the January 6, 2021 insurrection in Washington, D.C. This in spite of claiming he was, quote, a law and order president. Trump, who takes office as the first person in U.S. history to be a felon, has promised to unleash police from all restrictions and reincarcerate thousands, a move many interpret as directly aimed at black and brown communities. A new book examines the history, particularly in California, of prison as a tool of white supremacy, of particular relevance today. Its author is Dr. Brittany Friedman, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. She's also a faculty affiliate of the Equity Research Institute, and she now joins me to discuss her new book. It's called Carceral Apartheid: How Lies and White Supremacists Run Our Prisons. Welcome to the program, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you so much, Sonali, for having me today.
When we think of prisons, we don't always think of California, except maybe those of us who actually live in California and understand how serious our supposedly liberal prisons are run. Why do you focus on California? And can you tell me a little bit about how far back in history you go to make the case that prison is essentially a white supremacist institution?
I focus on California because, interestingly, our state is home to the four of the largest prisoner organizations that were founded in the United States. And so these include the Black Guerrilla Family, the Mexican Mafia, the Aryan Brotherhood, and Nuestra Familia. And I was very struck by the fact that one state seems to hold the origin story for these four major groups. And I wanted to investigate why. And I was very unsettled by the state narratives and the police narratives on how these organizations formed. And so I went in with a lot of curiosity. I also went in, you know, knowing from my previous research on prison pay to stay and work of that nature that, you know, state accounts of what happens in prison often contain a lot of falsehoods and lies. And so I went in, you know, thinking, what am I going to find? And I was very fortunate. I was able to connect with a number of communities in California over the span of a decade that were heavily engaged in the original formation of these groups. And what I found is that these organizations were founded as political organizations. Each organization obviously had a side, which you can glean from the names, but this very entrenched, you know, political nature actually came from interference by prison officials. And that's what I found so interesting, is how prison officials very much benefited from pitting incarcerated people against each other on the basis of race and encouraging these groups to go to war. And it made it much easier to control them. And I saw a lot of similarities in terms of how our country on the outside has for generations been obsessed with war and degradation as a means of controlling the masses.
I confess I'd never heard of the Black Guerrilla Family. Tell me about this organization and you know, what its goal has had been.
Yes, so the Black Guerrilla Family is the main group that I focus on in the book, but I use their story to tell the origin of these other groups that are founded at the same time. And so the Black Guerrilla Family is officially consolidated in 1970 in the wake of the Soledad incident, which is, you know, infamous nationwide, where three self-described Black militants are set up to die and they are murdered on the yard by correctional officers in Soledad. And, you know, this becomes a breaking point because my book really starts in the 50s, showing how prison officials were very threatened by people who were aligned with the civil rights movement, by people who were a part of what would become the Black Power movement. And so they set out to, one, segregate and isolate them in adjustment center cells, which I traced the history of adjustment centers based on archival research that I did. And they also
adjustment center sounds very Orwellian.
It is, believe me. I mean, it. So it, in that chapter alone, to my knowledge, it is the first in-depth historiography of adjustment centers, how they were tools to literally psychologically and physically readjust Black militant incarcerated people to using, you know, different means of torture, not just solitary, but also sexual assault, various types of setups in gladiator fights. And then they paired this with arming incarcerated Nazi groups that eventually became the Aryan Brotherhood. And so I show that the Aryan Brotherhood wouldn't be here today and wouldn't have grown so fast and so big without their alliance with corrupt correctional officers who saw them as an ally against the civil rights movement and against Black power. And so the Black Guerrilla Family emerged in this environment as a means of survival for incarcerated Black people. And that killing in Soledad really was the final spark. It was that, you know, in the interviews I did with co-founders of the Black Guerrilla Family, they told me, you know, it was that moment that we knew that we will die here anyway. And so why not organize ourselves, create a structure so that we can fight back against the Nazis that are now the Aryan Brotherhood and against their correctional officer friends. And so that's, you know, that is the case and the struggle that I use to really show the true nature of how our society runs.
So this is the sort of thing that went on within California prisons, in particular Soledad. Do you see this culture as intimately linked to the broader U.S. history of a nation built on enslavement, mass enslavement, and genocide, and racist discrimination on immigration, etc.? You know, it's a through line, of course, that continues today with President Trump's second term. So set the story of what you learned in your book in the broader U.S. context.
So in the broader U.S. context, my book is showing that historically, from the origin of when settler Europeans claimed to discover America and claimed to discover other what would become, you know, nation states, that claiming is rooted and based in, one, labeling indigenous populations and labeling people of color more broadly and labeling descendants of enslaved Africans, all groups that are being labeled as undesirable, as a means of political warfare. Because what my book shows is that when you label a population as undesirable, undeserving, it sets them up to then be eliminated using these official means that I document in terms of incarceration, policing, but also through these extra legal means that I document, which is the government knowingly and explicitly partnering with white supremacist civilians as a means of eradicating the quote-unquote undesirables of the populace. And we see that now with Trump. We saw it with January 6th in terms of who is a part of that riot, right? Research has shown that a sizable demographic of people were current or former law enforcement, military, right? And so Trump sees this group as his natural ally, just like the Department of Corrections in California saw the would-be Aryan Brotherhood as their natural ally.
Now, one of the big sort of lessons that I learned from your book is that the government and government institutions very much have benefited from using race to essentially ensure division, right? We are told today that diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives are racist, that we shouldn't see race because it is this construct. But of course, amplifying racial differences was precisely something that the U.S. government in its various formations and at various levels has used very effectively, right?
Absolutely. Division is one of the most powerful political tools for decimating populations and gaining control. We see it historically in a number of examples. We even see it within, you know, once you designate a particular racial group, for example, colonizers, and especially colonizers that engaged in chattel slavery, they knew that it was very effective if you then differentiate between enslaved peoples on the basis of skin color, for example. We see this in a number of, you know, post-colonial nations. I don't even like to use the word post-colonial because there is still a very overt and also covert, you know, arm of quote-unquote Western governments in their former colonies. And so this tool of division is very powerful. We also see this too, you know, in the false narratives about the genocide in Gaza and about Palestinians, right, in their homeland. I think that these are the through lines that, in my book, bringing in, you know, the Black guerrilla family, which very much they saw themselves as being a part of a global revolution of oppressed peoples. And so it is only fitting that I would then use their story in California and their origin and the war that the Department of Corrections declared against them to exemplify the nature of things more broadly in our world.
How do you apply the lessons from your book to the critique around mass incarceration today. There are the abolitionists and then there are the reformists. And the reformists might say, the lessons from your book are great, a great starting point to figure out how to make prison not white supremacist. Whereas the abolitionists might say, your book is precisely why we need to abolish prisons and policing because of these roots. How do you move forward?
Well, myself as an abolitionist, I think that, you know, my book very clearly shows that this is what you get when you have reform. And so what I mean by that is that I start in chapter 2 of my book showing the rise of mass solitary confinement in the form of adjustment centers and how those came out of a reform-minded public and also a reform-minded prison administration. And in their official documents, which I analyzed, right, they're thinking of mass solitary and these adjustment centers as being more humane, as being a way that we can use science to systematically identify who the problem inmates are, and then we can fix them. We can literally adjust them, which is why they're called adjustment centers, and we can change them and make them better. And what is so sick about this reform-minded nature of this is that, you know, this is coming out of an era in California where we have prison physicians like Leo Stanley, who I talk about in the book, who performed over 10,000 experiments on incarcerated people in the spirit of reform, because he thought, well, this is a way for me to fix them, and this is more humane because then I can send them back out there. But what we're talking about here is literally, you know, the stuff that we know happened in history in concentration camps, on plantations, on enslaved people, to indigenous people. The state has always performed torture as a means of quote unquote reforming problematic populations. And so that is why, for me, even finishing this work, I became even more of an abolitionist than I already was, because I was like, there's no way that I can unsee what I have seen in this book. And I truly feel that anyone who sees, who reads this and that is a reformist and isn't changed, I think that they're, you know, they're still holding on to the lies in our society. And I think that's unfortunate, but I do hope that they take off their glasses.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Brittany Friedman, for joining us today. Best of luck to you in your book. Really appreciate your time and your analysis.
Thank you, Sonali. I appreciate you.
My guest has been Dr. Brittany Friedman, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, faculty affiliate of the Equity Research Institute. Her new book, which we've just been discussing, is called Carceral Apartheid: How Lies and White Supremacists Run Our Prisons. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. How do we think about creating a world free from policing and prisons, a world where the constant fear of state violence is a thing of the past? We turn now to Gina Dent to help answer that question and to discuss how adopting an abolition mindset isn't just relegated to the criminal justice system. It means reimagining society as a whole, especially in how we think about our responsibilities to one another while balancing our individual rights. Gina Dent has spent years alongside the godmother of abolition, Angela Davis, in exploring how abolition ideals intersect with feminism and social justice movements. She co-directs the Visualizing Abolition Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she's a feminist studies professor. The project challenges narratives linking prisons to justice and imagines new ways of thinking about a prison-free future. She has also published a conversation with Angela Davis titled Prison as a Border and is co-author with Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie of the book Abolition Feminism. Now, I spoke with her last year as part of 12 interviews I did with leading abolitionists. It's part of my just published new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible. Here is Gina Dent.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
So when we talk about the conversations that entered into the national dialogue after 2020, during and after the racial reckoning, as some people call it, of 2020, there was a lot of lip service paid to the idea of abolition. Was that year for you a game changer, or have we since then as a society just returned to embracing policing and prisons as a quote unquote necessary part of society?
I don't know if I would say that moment was the game changer. I think really what preceded that moment, that made us ready for that moment, was the game changer. You know, it's the decades of work toward abolition. I'm specifically talking about prison abolition that really allowed us to take advantage of that moment, to be prepared for that moment, to know how to respond in that moment. The degree of sophistication that people had when they were asked about the viability of a society that operated without prisons and policing was really astonishing. I will say, however, that I think what did transform in that time period was a relationship, as I just mentioned, to policing rather than only imprisonment. The movement that I had been involved with previously was much more focused on the hidden aspects of our carceral system and less focused on things that were already being handled by a kind of another wing of the movement around stop and frisk or driving while black or difference in the rates of arrest, the treatment after arrest, et cetera, all that kind of work that people have been doing for a very long time. But I think the way that abolition became an all-encompassing address to the carceral system was really new in that moment in some ways. And I think also we have continued to stay with that movement, though I know a lot of municipalities are struggling with the actual unrolling of new ways of organizing society, but I don't think we're done with that.
You have written about abolition, as you said, for many years, but you've also specifically written about abolition and feminism. You're a professor of feminist studies, and you wrote alongside Angela Davis a book specifically focused on abolitionism and feminism, and that feminism cannot be attached to incarceration, that feminism has to be anti-racist and anti-capitalist. And I'm wondering if you can share that a little bit more with our audience in terms of how feminism needs to redefine itself in an abolitionist world or post-abolitionist world.
So I guess I'd put it slightly differently. So that book, which is called Abolition Feminism Now, is a collaborative book project between myself, Angela Davis, as you mentioned, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie. And all of us had been involved in different ways in the abolitionist movement for a long time. We had known each other for a very long time in the movement, and we really saw the need to address what we used to address mostly in the hallways, between events or after events with each other, either the problem of the failure to address feminist issues in abolitionist contexts or the problem of not thinking about abolition when doing feminist work, specifically against domestic violence and other forms of interpersonal violence. So that really doesn't mean that we can wait for abolition to then transform our feminism. It really means that it's a necessary component of both abolition and feminism. And so we treated abolition feminism as a compound noun. In other words, you can take one part out and do the abolition part, and then you can do the feminist part separately. We really believe and tried to strongly state the case that separating out those elements from that compound noun would do violence to our movements. And so balancing the need to address state harm and interpersonal harm and moving to a society that organizes us differently in relationship to each other and how we deal with harms between us is important. And it's not something that can be thought about as an additive way of relating to the issue, or even something that we could address post facto.
There was a time when the term restorative justice was very trendy, and I'm wondering if that is still a relevant term or idea, in as much as we can even think about how we apply it to harm reduction or tackling harm in, you know, with regard to interpersonal violence.
So restorative justice is a term that I hear used sometimes interchangeably with other terms within the abolitionist movement. I live in Oakland, California. In Oakland, California, there is an organization called Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth that I've been affiliated with for a long time, and know, I don't work with them, but I know of them, and I've been close to people who are involved in that work. And some part of that work would probably be what I would think of as abolitionist, and some part of that work might be in another area. I've heard people use the term restorative justice in so many contexts. So I would say that though it's not the term I generally use, I tend to use transformative justice. I even work in transitional justice frameworks that are more global. But I'm less concerned about the actual labels that people use when they're doing this kind of work. I'm more concerned with evaluating how much the organizations, the practices, the ways of relating are feeding the carceral system and how much they're moving us away from carcerality. I think sometimes restorative justice has been tricky in the sense that it has built itself upon cultural practices that are first maybe overly white, Quaker, not a Christian, and not necessarily embracing of all, and then increasingly moving toward more African diaspora centered practices and indigenous practices. And I think those things really work in communities where that cultural fabric is strong. But I think it's hard to move those same practices into every environment. So well, I find that people are using restorative justice as the name for practices that I would recognize more under the category of transitional justice or transformative justice. And really, I think that those of us in the abolitionist movement are less concerned with the labels, and we're much more concerned with what we're doing to build together.
So then how do we define these forms of justice, transitional or transformative justice? What, you know, I think a lot of people who identify with the tenets of abolition still feel like they need some concrete examples of what that could look like when harm is done. If we don't rely on policing, courts, and prisons, what do we rely on? And I know that, you know, there's so much more to be said in terms of how we reduce harm by funding the things that keep us safe to begin with. But of course, we can't necessarily completely eradicate when harm is done. Mm-hmm. by fully funding all the things that we need. So what do the nuts and bolts of a new system look like?
Well, many people have argued in the movement that we have a lot of the nuts and bolts. It's not as if we're acting as if we're going to build the society completely anew. We're trying to reinvigorate, revitalize those practices that are equitable, healing, and where our interpersonal relationships are not dependent on racial hierarchies, sexual hierarchies, gender hierarchies, other kinds of, certainly, of course, class, which is maybe the most important one to draw out. And so those ways of thinking deeply about societal inequities and reaching for a way of embracing all is fundamental to what it means to build toward abolition. So we have some of those practices, and people are actually doing this work in local spaces, and that's so exciting to see. A lot of that work is invisibilized by the media, and I think it's really important for those of us who are involved in these organizations and municipalities to keep telling the stories of what's happening around us. My work has been much more focused on national and international or transnational organizing, but I know that there are many people who are around me in Oakland who are working daily on these questions. And in the backlash to the turn toward abolition, there has really been an elimination of coverage of the stories that would allow us to be able to imagine how we would live together. No one, I don't know anyone in the abolitionist movement who is naive about harms or violence. I think that in fact, when we are talking, most of us are survivors of some form of violence. And many people come to the movement because they're so dissatisfied with what they find once they confront the carceral system. Those of us who authored Abolition Feminism Now together were very much focused especially on gender violence, on the ways that people are so disappointed when they have been harmed and they then have to try and process that harm while being further harmed by our carceral system and our quote unquote justice system. And so as they're being poked and prodded and asked questions and having to recount what happened, and then witnessing the individualization both of what happened to them, but also of what the perpetrator has done, those things feel very unsatisfying for people who are survivors of violence. And so I think we are driven to think about other ways that we can manage that violence. And we're not saying that it will immediately go. I don't think any of us are imagining a future where there won't be other harms. There might be different harms. There might be different patterns. But there will probably be people who are more vulnerable than others. And so it's not to say there wouldn't be consequences. The question is, do those consequences actually help to build a healthier society? Or do those consequences invisibilize the problem to the extent that we are now committing further violence, the violence of incarceration, the violence of punishment that has no actual capacity to help people to rebuild their lives? And those ways of handling the problems continue to feed and reinforce the very violence. So prison is not a place that solves violence. Prison is a place that actually replicates the violence, extends that violence, extends it out into the communities where people are living around prisons, and also extends that violence back into the community when people are released. If it's not the violence that people imagine, meaning what we call violent crimes. It's the violence of not being able to make a good life when you have done your sentence, of continuing to be perceived as someone who is a felon or a criminal and can never actually return to society to be a part of things in the way that one could without a record. And because of the patterns that we know we have in terms of incarceration and policing, we cannot continue to allow that to happen. But I think feminists have really been leading us, abolition feminists have been leading us in working at the practices of care that build on the forms of collectivity that are very fragile, that are not encouraged in our societies, but that we nonetheless have. And sometimes it means building back on those very cultural practices I mentioned earlier. A lot of us, whether we're Indigenous or not, are reaching for those practices that have been described through Indigenous communities, not to romanticize them, not to extract them from the larger cultural fabric and the other issues, but to continue to learn and think through and compare and practice, you know, what it means to create a different relationship to land, to territory, to property, to capital. And those practices are key to our understanding how to truly address harm, not to move the treatment of harm to some domain that actually creates more harms and doesn't actually address the problem. You know, what are our responsibilities toward each other? You know, one way of kind of imagining what this might be like, we can, you know, think about through the, you know, metaphor of the mask these days, right? People who are like won't wear a mask to prevent someone else from getting COVID. You know, what does that mean about a culture that where people think that, you know, it's their right to be mask free versus it's their obligation, it's their responsibility to care for others, even if they themselves could be healthy without wearing a mask. You know, it's not a perfect example, but I think the analogy allows us to see that we need to be much more responsibility-based in our way of understanding our lives. And we should be, toward each other, imagining that we can interact in ways that where we know we are going to be supported, and we're also not so invested in building up our individual personal narratives, even in terms of being activists. You know, this is something that comes up a lot. You know, who's going to be the leader, right? And during the phase before 2020 of Black Lives Matter and emerging and other people talking in a different way, sometimes through Black feminism and sometimes for other reasons, the culture that reinforces, especially through the carceral system, and teaches us these forms of individualization.
I want to thank you so much, Gina Dent, for this wonderful conversation. Really appreciate your incredible insight.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the work.
My guest has been Dr. Gina Dent, who co-directs the Visualizing Abolition Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she's a feminist studies professor. She's the co-author with Angela Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie of the book Abolition Feminism Now. The transcript of this conversation is one of 12 interviews with abolitionists included in my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, just published by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. We'll be right back.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.